years since that theme song first hit TV. The original version, of course, had William Shatner's voice talking about Star Trek's five-year mission, which now you have to call a 50-year mission. In fact, that's what Ed Gross and Mark Altman have done in their oral history of Star Trek. The book is called The 50-Year Mission, and Ed joins us now here on the Big 550 KTRS. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Is it true that you went to the first Star Trek convention?
I did. I was all of 12 years old in Manhattan at the then-called Statler Hilton Hotel.
And what was that like for a 12-year-old boy? I'm guessing there were no 12-year-old girls.
Oh, I probably didn't even notice at the time. There probably weren't, though.
Uh-huh.
I remember the chaos of it. I remember the crowd of it, a good chaos, not an insane chaos. I put an anecdote in the book. It's true, too, that there's a long line for something, and I asked somebody what the line was for, and they said, autographs for Gene Roddenberry, and I looked at him and said, who's Gene Roddenberry? And this guy just looked at me and said, you're on the wrong line, kid. I mean, I knew Star Trek. I didn't know Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah. He's only the guy who created the thing.
Exactly. I was 12.
Yeah, I understand. Now, I was a Star Trek fan as a kid, and through the first few movies, the good and the bad.
Yeah.
Then I lost track of it when it went off into the spin-offs, the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and whatever else came after that. But I do have to ask, on this 50th anniversary of the TV show's debut this year, why is this still a thing a half century later?
I have to believe, and it sounds so corny and cliched at this point, but I have to believe it's what it represents, which is that hope for the future, that somehow we're going to overcome all our obstacles and become united as a people. Now, it sounds corny, but when you hear the headlines, read the headlines every day, and the news every day, and today, in fact, with all the shootings and everything else, we need to be unified, and maybe that's part of the appeal and has been the appeal. It shows us that we can be unified if we work towards it.
Yeah, but we can't quite get it together with the Klingons and the Romulans.
Well, we seem to work it out with them. That's the problem.
I mean, the Star Trek universe is not a utopian universe.
No. What it postulates is that humanity on Earth is trying to overcome its problems, and it's going out there and trying to help people solve the problems, even if they don't want our help.
I never liked the word Klingon. I never liked that whole thing with the on Star Trek.
No.
But where did that come from? Do you know? Does anyone know?
It was the creation of Gene L. Coon, the producer of the show, that worked from the middle of the first season to the middle of the second season and brought a lot of what we know about Star Trek to the show. He just came up with this word, Klingon. He didn't have any idea where it came from. Just popped in his head.
Now, Ed, I got to ask you this. Since you've been following Star Trek and been a fan of it since you were a very, very small boy.
A wee lad.
Do you speak Klingon?
No, I do not speak Klingon.
Okay.
I am proud to say I do not speak Klingon.
Oh, good, because I didn't want to have to end this interview right then.
No. Hey, I respect anybody who chooses to speak Klingon, but I choose not to. So
the book, The 50-Year Mission, actually is a two-part book. You have the first part out now about the first 25 years, and so let's go back to the very beginning. Explain to me how Lucille Ball is responsible for Star Trek.
I mean, no, people really don't know this story, and it's so funny because Lucille Ball had, was in control of Desilu Studios, and they were looking for television shows because their studios had become mostly a rental place as opposed to creating original productions. So the idea of Star Trek and Mission Impossible were both brought to Lucy at the same time, and the board of directors reportedly looked at the cost of those two shows and said no. Lucy seemed to think that there was something to them, that they had the chance to have a longevity, just as I Love Lucy was having at the time. And she decided to overrule the board and said, yes, we have to do these shows. And so if it wasn't for Lucy, there would be no Star Trek.
Wow.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, what's interesting is, in the Star Trek lore, the show went on the air, didn't do that really big ratings, and was on the verge of being canceled, and then there was a letter writing campaign. What's the story behind that, Ed?
It really was the fans. We spoke to a lot of these fans that initiated the campaign, actually, in 1967. What it was is that they loved Star Trek so much, and they realized that if they didn't have close to 100 episodes, they needed a third season for the show to go into syndication. Because if it didn't go into reruns and syndication, then Star Trek would have vanished forever. Mm. And they were aware of that. So they fought like hell. They started letter-writing campaigns. I mean, and it spread. And this is pre-internet. You know, everything was word of mouth and through the mail.
Yep.
And somehow they did it. They came up with enough letters. You know, the rumors go between 100,000 letters to 1,000,000 letters, but whatever it is, NBC basically had no choice but to renew the show and go on the air for the first time ever and announce that the show was coming back during the end credits and to please stop writing.
Our mail room can't take it anymore.
Exactly. Somebody has to handle every piece of that mail.
Wow. Yep. But I read in your book that they actually got less money for each year of the show. And the first year of the three, they got the most, less the second, and a little bit less the third. That's unheard of with a renewed show.
Paramount bought Desilu. I mean, unfortunately, Lucy's board of directors was right, and they fell short. Every episode lost money in its first run, and Lucy couldn't hang on long enough to, you know, get the show into reruns. So she ended up having to sell Desilu because of Star Trek, because of Mission Impossible. The studio just couldn't keep going.
It's that syndication, those reruns, that really made this continue for all this time. I mean, if it weren't for that, if it were only on the air for those 3 years, it would have been gone, forgotten, and never turned into a movie or a spinoff or anything else.
I mean, we spoke to this guy named Richard Block, who was part of Kaiser Television at the time, and he was the first one to go to Paramount. He knew somebody in distribution and said, you know what, I want to get reruns of this to go up against local newscasts. And the guy looked at him and said, you're crazy, we don't even know if the show's coming back for a third year, nobody's going to want to watch this thing. And of course, he programmed it against local newscasts and destroyed them ratings-wise. Hmm. And then other networks, you know, independent channels, started doing the same thing. And audiences found it, discovered it, and started watching it five nights a week. And that's where the popularity really grew.
You talk to a lot of people who worked on this show. You have quotes from the late Gene Roddenberry and from the late Leonard Nimoy and from all of these people who were on the show and behind the scenes on the show as well. Do any of them look back at it as cheesy? You know, I don't mean the concept. I mean the sets, the boulders that were obviously made out of styrofoam that bounced off of people when they hit them, some of the acting led by Shatner, etc. What do they look at it as in hindsight?
I think in hindsight, it takes on a glow. Even the bad takes on a glow to people. Do you know what I mean? After 50 years and you're talking about it and everybody is praising your name and saying the wonderful thing you did in this show. And for a large part of it, they did. But I think what happens is it colors your perception of it. So you look back at it, and on the one hand, you may want to say, oh, it's just a TV show, you know, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, everyone's been telling you you're wonderful for all these years. Why are you going to look back and say it's bad?
Yeah. But if you took somebody who was 16 years old now, and they liked the J.J. Abrams reboot movies, Star Trek Into Darkness, mm-hmm. and they've got this new one coming out this year called Star Trek Beyond. If you showed them that, and because of that, they went back and found, you know, streaming versions of the original series, they would probably laugh.
Oh, look, I have three sons, and they're all in their 20s, and they won't watch the original series. I mean, the irony is, though, that, you know, they love the J.J. movies, and then I was watching Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, with one of my sons, who was 22 at the time, and he looked at me in the middle of the movie, and he goes, hey, Dad, Star Trek's supposed to be about something, huh? Had to love that.
There's a moral to this story?
You mean it's about something? You mean they're trying to tell us something? Wait a minute. I thought that was very funny.
How much credit does J.J. Abrams get for rebooting this thing and keeping it alive?
Let me tell you, and this is my honest feeling about it. Whatever you think of the J.J. movies, I happen to like them. I have issues with certain things, but overall I like them. The truth of the matter is that the Star Trek franchise was in its death throes in 2002. Enterprise was going off the air with terrible ratings. Voyager's ratings had slipped terribly. The movies Insurrection and Nemesis this had bombed at the box office, it was over, basically. This thing was going on to life support. And then a few years later, J.J. had the idea of saying, of reinvigorating it by giving it a little of the Star Wars-type energy. And it worked, and it opened it up to a whole new audience and brought it all back to life because suddenly there was more interest in the original series again and that sort of thing because of the success of these movies.
And now we have the third one coming, as I mentioned, Star Trek Beyond. What do you know about it?
You know, I'm anxiously waiting. I mean, initially I was very concerned that they were selling it like Guardians of the Galaxy as opposed to Star Trek, so I wasn't too crazy about that. But I've spoken to a couple of people who have seen it without giving me spoilers, and they're actually very impressed. They're saying that it's better than Star Trek Into Darkness, not quite as good as the 2009 Star Trek film.
Yeah, you know about the Sulu controversy?
Yeah, absolutely.
George Takei is not happy that they're making his character, who is now played by John Cho, that Sulu is going to be gay in this third movie. They thought they were doing it as a tribute to him, but Takei says that this is out of step with what Gene Roddenberry would have wanted.
See, and I don't see that. I mean, the only reason there wasn't a gay character on the original Star Trek is because no TV show was going to put a gay character on television at the time.
Yeah.
It just wasn't going to happen. So as open-minded as you want to be, in the times that Star Trek was created, it couldn't happen. But in today's society, why not? I mean, why not make it inclusive? What's wrong with that? I'm very surprised that George is having the reaction that he's having.
Well, he by the way, there was such an uproar when Kirk and Uhura were forced to kiss by those Roman gods, or whatever happened on that show, I can't remember. A white man and a black woman kissing on TV in 1967 nearly shut down the network. So they definitely weren't going to do anything about Sulu coming out of the closet. But I was surprised that he said, that George said, unfortunately, this is a twisting of Gene's creation to which he put in so much thought. I think it's really unfortunate. That's so odd.
It's a very odd statement. I don't get it because, if anything, I believe this embraces even more than what Roddenberry was hoping to do with Star Trek, which, again, is to have that all-inclusive element to it.
As I mentioned, you talk to a lot of people. Tell me a story about William Shatner versus Leonard Nimoy.
There are many stories.
Pick one.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is this. William Shatner was hired to be the star of this television series. It was a star vehicle for him. Leonard Nimoy was a co-star whose popularity grew extremely quickly and, in fact, eclipsed that of Shatner's Kirk. Shatner did not take too well to that.
He really? The Shatner ego couldn't handle that?
No. I'm not going to put the Shat down. I'm just saying. At the time, though, and I guess if you put yourself in his position, you could understand you're the star of the show, and suddenly you're not the star of the show. You're the co-star of the show. So I get it. However, my understanding is the behavior after that was not so great. And we found the memo that Gene Roddenberry had written to both Shatner and Nimoy, and slightly to Kelly, but not DeForest Kelly, but not quite as much. And it's basically calling them both out on their behavior, on how they were allowing their egos to potentially threaten the future of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really powerful memo. I mean, it really is. And I think it, for anybody who tries to say, when Shatner says, oh, well, Leonard and I, we were like brothers, that's great. Except this memo shows that the sibling rivalry was little more than that.
I like your reading of that line in the Shatner style.
Yeah,
thank
that
you.
Was good.
I have my Shatnerisms every now and then. Yeah.
Well, I'm just glad that the two of them decided to record some rock songs later on. Because I always need punishment music for the Harris Challenge, and they do that. Now, I got to ask you about Spock in the movies.
Yeah.
They kill him off at the end of Wrath of Khan, the second movie. When they did that, did they already know in their minds, well, we'll just make a third movie called The Search for Spock? Was that planned out ahead of time?
I don't think it was. I think what the impression I get from talking to people is that Nimoy kind of didn't want to do Star Trek II because the Star Trek the motion picture did not go well.
Oh, it was a bad, bad movie.
Yeah, well, there's more to it, I think, than people realize.
No,
but
it's a bad,
it's a really
bad movie.
Boring, slow movie. I'll give you that.
Okay.
Really boring.
Yeah.
That being said, he had a terrible time making the movie, and he really wasn't interested in doing Star Trek II. Then producer Harve Bennett, who took over from Gene Roddenberry, basically said, how would you like to play your death scene? And Leonard Nimoy liked that because he thought it would allow the character to go out with some dignity. But he was having such a good time with Nicholas Meyer directing, and the script was so good, and, you know, Ricardo Montalban was Khan, and everything was coming together in the movie so well that he started saying to people behind the scenes, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to coming back for another one. So they added that little bit with him putting his hand on McCoy's face and saying, remember. And then they projected his body onto that planet to be regenerated for Star Trek III. And then, of course, he was allowed to direct, so he came back and he directed his own Search.
But there, there must have been a time for a while where they knew he wanted to come back for another movie, but they already had the script and they'd already filmed this one, and they didn't know what that movie was going to be.
Well, they didn't know what that movie was going to be, but they weren't going to change this one. They were all very, very happy with the screenplay that Nicholas Meyer had done the final rewrite on. So they weren't going to change this. However, they added certain things into it to suggest that Spock could be back. In fact, the final shot was something of his the photon torpedo with Spock's body on the planet's surface was something Nicholas Meyer had nothing to do with. He hated the idea.
Oh, I know what happened. I think what happened was they had Spock in the shower on the Enterprise, and he figured out he was dreaming the entire thing.
This is Dallas, not Dallas, it's Star Trek.
Of the original movies that they made, Star Trek IV was easily the most popular and the biggest moneymaker of all of them. Was that because it was the only one with a sense of humor?
I think a large part of it was the sense of humor, and I think it also took place in our time. And that makes a big difference. When you take even these guys from the future and have sort of the culture shock, think of Back to the Future with Marty McFly going from 1985 back to 1955.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of humor is mined from the fact that this guy is a fish out of water, mm-hmm. right? You know he's cool in the 80s, but he ain't so cool in the 50s, at least not at first. Same thing with these guys. They're like, you know, the best that people can be in the 23rd century, but bring them back to 1986. And they don't have exact change for the bus.
Yeah, and if you're going to do fish out of water, get a whale.
Well, the ultimate fish out of water story.
That's a tip for you filmmaking kids out there. Get a whale if you're doing fish out of water.
Exactly. And you know, Star Trek IV is the one that everyone refers to as the one with the whale.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. The book is called The 50-Year Mission, The Complete, Uncensored, Unauthorized Oral History of Star Trek. And the first 25 years are in the first volume that is available now from Amazon and everywhere else, co-written by Mark Altman and this gentleman right here, Ed Gross. Thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.